welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Turn the Page podcast. My name is Jessica. I am one of your hosts today. My co-host is
Jen. Hello, everyone.
And we're so excited about this interview and this author and this book. This was a book that as soon as just the cover and the title came across our screen, we're like, yes, must have it, must read it. And then we read it and it was incredible. So please introduce yourself and tell us about Her Majesty's Royal Coven.
I would love to. Thank you for having me. My name is Juno Dawson. I am the author of Her Majesty's Royal Coven. It's the story of five very powerful witches who have known each other since childhood. Now they're grown up, they're in their 30s. Some of them work for the official coven of the United Kingdom and others don't. I'm sorry about the building work that's happening outside my apartment. There's nothing I can do about that, sorry. Just adds flavour. It makes me feel like a real person, doesn't it? But the novel concerns what happens when the oracles of Her Majesty's Royal Coven predict an apocalyptic end of witchkind. And then there is an ideological split between this group of friends about how they should tackle the problem. And it threatens not just their friendship group, but it threatens the whole universe.
So I absolutely loved this book. Oh my gosh, it was absolutely riveting. I read it in like a day and a half. It was just
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I was most interested in, because I was a medieval historian before I was a library worker, and I love how it uses actual history and, talks about the sort of the magic bubbling under the surface of all of the events that we know. And I was wondering if we could start with you maybe talking a little bit about how you decided to incorporate Anne Boleyn and the Tudor court and how that worked into your whole alternate history.
I think it gives it such depth. It's what I like. When you're doing witches or vampires, I think you have just this golden opportunity to start in the modern day, but fully understand that this is something that has got centuries of history behind it. It means that my characters who are modern, young, millennial women, it means that they just have a backstory even beyond their personal backstory. And of course, when you're writing from the United Kingdom, you know, what could be more English than exploring the royal family? And of course, Anne Boleyn in particular is such an enigma. You know, we know so little about her because after she was executed, you know, there was a real concerted attempt to kind of erase her from history. And of course, that has such modern echoes with the notion of erasure or cancellation. You know, the rumors have existed for generations that Anne Boleyn was in some way involved in the occult or the esoteric. Personally, do I believe that? No, I think it's probably an attempt to discredit somebody that the monarch wanted dead. But it's way more fun if we believe she was a witch. And that's kind of the starting point. So, you know, when, you know, there will be, I have no doubt as we move through the world of Her Majesty's Royal Coven, there will be other historical figures who it's suggested are part of this long dynasty of witches as well, going well before Anne Boleyn, as we will explore in book two. But I'm not going to say anything about book two now. It's too soon for book two.
I was about to say I loved all the characters, but not so much. I loved most of the characters.
I know who you mean.
Yes.
But we'll talk about her in a bit because I've got a soft spot for her as well.
Yeah, I was really, and this is not to give spoilers, but I was really surprised and by her start to the end of the book. And again, I don't want to say any more than that because that will spoil things. But so you have these childhood friends, you have Helena, Neve, Kara, Leonie, and Elle. And they were Spice Girls fans, as one was back in the day of that age. And they all had powers, and they all came from different households, but maybe not so much some as others. Like Leonie came from, she's Black, and she comes from a household that sort of frowned upon her magical abilities. She's also gay, and you find that out. That's not so much a spoiler. You find that out fairly early after you meet her as a child. And then you see them all as adults. And it's interesting because I feel like it is very much how like a tight friend group would change and kind of see their ideals change. But you do have that witchcraft background. And it also leads me for a question that Jen and I were both curious about. One of their mentors is named Annie DeVice. Is that a reference to Good Omens?
So now, here's something I learned in my research. That surname is pronounced Devis.
Oh my.
Not so. Yeah, I know. So I was saying device for a long, long time because obviously a kitchen device. But right. No, it's when it's a name in Yorkshire or Lancashire, it's Devis. And the reason that Neil Gaiman and I have both used that surname is because one of the women killed at the Pendle Witch Trials was a Devis. So, however, the youngest Devis, Jeanette Devis, survived. And so it figured, I think it figured to be me and Gaiman alike, that potentially there were still Pendle witches from that dynasty who were alive. So yes, yeah, so Annie Devis is a nod to the very real women who were killed in Pendle in the 17th century.
Wow. That's something that I did not know.
Well, so yeah, I mean, because obviously you had your own Salem witch trials, you know, and I think so that's the thing. So I can't imagine that the Pendle witch trials would be as well known in the States. But yeah, they were one of many, many witch trials that existed under King James I. Elizabeth, I want to say great nephew, I think he was, because obviously there was a succession crisis after Elizabeth. Yeah, and he really wasn't a fan of witches, and of course he wrote a treatise on witch finding. So yeah, the Devis family, although they're an interesting story in themselves, I would say to listeners, there's plenty out there on YouTube and plenty of material about the Devises, because actually the thing that Salem and Pendle had in common, and what they both have in common with Her Majesty's Royal Coven, is that women / witches are in grave danger when they turn on each other. Mm-hmm. Because the Pendle witch trials are a key example of what happens when basically it was two different families trying to sell each other out to the authorities. They were all executed. And there is a lesson to be learned there for the characters in Her Majesty's Royal Coven as well. And that's really, I guess, what the book's about. It's about female coalition, but it's more fun if we say it's about witches.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that I really loved about this book is how, you know, this conflict kind of comprises an external battle against demonic forces, as well as sort of like fascistic magic wielders, you know, who have a very different vision of what the world should look like and the relationship between witches and the mundane. But that is unfolding alongside this very internal conflict among witches about inclusion and identity and who gets to say who we are or what our identity is. And the way that those two conflicts feed into each other and are like essential to each other is fantastic. You know, it's just riveting.
And that's not an accident. I mean, that's very reassuring for me too, because that means that my intention for the novel has come across. So it's quite worrying when people are like, oh, and I just thought this was a novel about, you know, Anglo-French relations. And you're like, oh, no, it's not meant to be. But no, this really, really is meant to be. And that's really what the whole trilogy is. So the first book in particular looks at division between women and conflict between women. And then the second and third book in particular look at the role within women under the patriarchy more broadly. And that's, you know, as a trans woman living in the United Kingdom, I am not deaf to the conversations that are happening around trans women in the British press. And this is, I'm glad that this is coming across to an American audience as well, because nowhere else in the world is having quite the situation we're having with the British press at the moment, which is when I come to America, when I go to Australia or most of the places in Europe, it's very political, which is the right tends to be anti-trans, the left tends to be very inclusive. Whereas in the United Kingdom, those lines are just skewed, you know, and we've got some quite liberal news outlets trotting out some very transphobic rhetoric. And of course, I wrote HMRC during lockdown one. So I was stuck in my apartment listening to misinformation about trans people. And as an artist, of course, it was influencing what I wanted to write. But I didn't want to write a serious academic nonfiction text about the history of trans inclusion or the history of trans people. And actually, those books have been written and they've been done incredibly well. I wanted to write a story about something that I loved, which is witchcraft and magic and sisterhood and solidarity and feminism, but also, you know, it came from that very simple what if. And I think all the best books come from a what if, which is, what if a transgender witch tried to join a coven? Let's go from there. And vitally as well, kind of, it was really important to me to explore it from the point of view of the cisgender women around that character, which is why the trans character, no spoilers, the trans character doesn't have a lot to say, because actually it's about the perception of trans people as much as it is trans people. But what I will say is the trans character has much more to say in book two and three. So that's just, no spoilers, no spoilers.
She's wonderful. She was such a lovable character. And there was just no way that as the reader, you just didn't want to protect her at all costs. And there's just a lot of chat within the book, and it echoes just what you were just saying about how inclusion is sort of skewed and it's not as hard political as it is in other places as to what constitutes feminism. And there is a character which is definitely what one would consider a TERF and a gatekeeper on who mm-hmm. gets to be a woman and who gets to determine what based on just, you know, like she considers herself quote unquote open-minded, but when she talks, not so much. Yeah. And you realize that. And unfortunately, her friends are realizing that this person that they thought maybe was a bit stuffy is actually quite horrible in some of her beliefs and a lot of her beliefs, and rigid to the point that she will not bend. She will not open up just even that dialogue to be like, well, maybe, you know, okay, maybe this is kind of how I perceived things, or how like the wave of feminism I came into perceived things, but it's not necessarily correct. And maybe I should start listening. How did you sort of decide, you know, when the conversations were going to come in?
Mm. So that character, again, I won't say which of the characters it is, takes a turn for the worse. But she was as important to me as the other four, in that I really, really wanted to try and understand where some of this rhetoric was coming from, because I am surrounded by cisgender women in both my personal life and in my professional life who have done nothing but be supportive, who have helped me through the very difficult early years of my transition when my life was very much in turmoil. You know, I had this team of publicists and editors and friends and my mum and my sister. And it's only really when I go online that I was experiencing this kind of transphobia. But then I was finding myself in situations where I was at a launch party and all of a sudden somebody would just leave. And I'd be like, was that something I said? And they're like, no, it's just something you were, you know? And so I really wanted to sort of sit down and see if I could try not sympathize, because I don't, and I don't think we should ever sympathize with prejudice or bigotry, but I wanted to see if I could fathom it. And it was a valuable experience, because by the end of it, I realized, oh, it's just bigotry. You know, I really did. I was like an archaeologist. I had my little brush, my little air squirter. I was brushing off the bones of all these kind of theories and, you know, kind of all the scaremongering and the fears, because actually I do think, I will say that, I think there are people in this world who are genuinely fearful of what trans people mean for women or for gender or for boys or for the binary. But I dug away and I examined it really, really closely, and an unfounded fear about a minority group is a prejudice, you know, and I was like, oh, look at that. So actually it was a really important journey for me to go on with that character, because there was something in the back of my mind that did partly blame myself. I was like, you are a problem. You are a problem on this planet. You are causing a problem. And then I realized, actually, I'm not causing a problem. I'm just living as I'm just living. And there are lots of people on this planet who are living. And then there are other people who have a problem with those people living. And actually, I think that's their problem, not my problem.
Really quickly, I just wanted to mention, I have just sort of written down in my notes, and I think it's really important to mention that this book is also very funny. At points, it's very funny. I have written down my notes say funny and compelling, like Buffy, but written with more care.
Well, I mean, Buffy is remarkable for a show that wrote itself and had no creator. Do you know, one of these days, our 90s heroes will just stop disappointing us. But sadly, today is not that day. I grew up on Buffy. I loved Buffy. Buffy made me who I am in so many ways. And it certainly made me the writer that I am. I think it's about as perfect as a TV show can be. And, you know, obviously Willow was so important to me as a queer teenager as well. You know, really, Willow was one of the first times I saw sort of a queer character that I could really chime with in the 90s. And I've tried to write terribly, terribly serious novels. It just doesn't work. And I had to figure that one out quite early on in my YA career, which is I just don't do serious very well. And, you know, in real life, people are funny, you know, and that's why this novel is set in the real world. You know, I'm a huge fan of, I love me some kind of Samantha Shannon and sort of big, meaty fantasy novels, but I like fantasy that feels real. And so I think by setting Her Majesty's Royal Coven in a world that we all recognize, it's modern day England, 2022, but they're also witches. I just think it makes it feel realer. And actually, you know, even within high fantasy, even within Leigh Bardugo or George R.R. Martin, characters are funny. People make each other laugh. And actually, I think if you experience the highs of those characters and the good times and the romantic bits and the funny bits, when those characters are in peril, you feel it more keenly because you just don't want them to die. And I always think the best horror films are the horror films where you deeply care for the characters, because you care if they make it to the end or not.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that sort of balance between humor going through incredible struggle is something that also happens, you know, in the real world constantly for people who are, you know, experiencing those sorts of things. But speaking about the book feeling real, like one of the things that really made it feel so real to me was that it felt like such a more vivid and real UK, you know, and so much more diverse and inclusive. You know, if we were to compare it to another sort of big magical property, which also has no creator, like that one is very, it's very London and it's very posh, you know, and it's very like everybody's sort of the same. But this one has such a, you know, it's set in the north and it has such a larger range of people from different countries within the UK and from places beyond that. And, you know, I think it's just so much more, believable.
Yeah, and Hebden Bridge is real. I mean, I've said this, not everybody in America knows Hebden Bridge is a real place. And I would say visit. It's everything I wrote in the book about Hebden is true. It's the lesbian capital of the United Kingdom. It's where Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath lived. It's where Sylvia Plath is buried. It's beautiful and it doesn't make a lick of sense. Like I grew up 25 minutes from Hebden Bridge in Bradford, which is nothing like Hebden Bridge. It's like an industrial mill town, you know, and so it doesn't make any sense. It shouldn't exist, but it does. And I think we have a word for that, and it's magic. You know, there is just something a little bit magic about it. But you're right. I mean, I didn't know that Her Majesty's Royal Coven was going to sell in the United States or across Europe. I'm very glad it has. But I hope that for people who haven't traveled the United Kingdom, it opens the gate to the fact that there is a whole United Kingdom that exists outside of London and the South. That yes, the North isn't perhaps always as pretty as the South, but there's so much up there, you know, and book two, there's a lot in Manchester. I think Manchester is as cool a city as London. I think if your listeners get a chance to come to the UK, make sure you take in the North and take in Scotland. Gosh, Scotland is something very special. So
I have to say, I cannot wait for the next book in this series. I cannot wait.
I finished. Just sent it to my editor last week. It's done. She's done. She's finished.
When can we expect it?
I think it'll be next summer. So I think we're going to do one a year just because we don't want to bring out two super close together. And then because I've not even started the third one. So so I think we'll pace them. So yeah, book one this summer, book two next summer, and then book three, hopefully the summer after that. But let's see what happens next.
Because there's so much I want to talk about, but I also can't because it, other than what we talked about, it will just spoil the whole book. And that makes me very sad for people who might listen to this because you don't want this spoiled. You need to just sit down and read this book.
Oh, thank you. Yes, there is quite a big finish. Yeah, sorry, Sov.
Actually, really quickly, just the whole like backstory, because this is also one of those novels that sort of comes post-magical war. So mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, like the characters will be present, but you'll know that there was a magical war that came before. How much of that did you sort of map out, or is it just sort of like, this is a thing that happened, but we're going to talk about going forward.
So I'm a big believer in that you should never start at the beginning, that you should always start halfway through a story. And it was important to me that those women came to page one with trauma. You know, I think everything that happens in this trilogy is these four women dealing with what has happened to them previously. And we do find out, you know, gradually drop-wise, we find out what has happened, why they're so hardened. You know, Niamh is so shut off, living in her little routine. Elle is in denial. Helena has this rhino thick skin. And Leonie is she's almost retreated from the rest of her friends. She's kind of gone solo. She's done the Mel B. Kind of, she's done a Jerry. She's done a Ginger Spice. And so, and that's, you know, really... Yes, it's about witches, but it's about those four characters. And it's really fun. Obviously, I'm two thirds of the way through this journey with them now, but I'm going to miss them. I don't want it to end. I think that's why I'm reluctant to start book three, because I just don't want it to finish ever.
I know we have to close soon, but I just wanted to kind of give a nod. You're working in the Hooniverse, the Doctor Hooniverse.
I am. So I've done, if you can get BBC Sounds app, Doctor Who Redacted is available now. It's the first official scripted podcast. It's an audio drama starring Jodie Whittaker and the amazing Charlie Craig's a trans actress. And yeah, what a gig to be doing an official Doctor Who story. Check it out. It's funny, it's science fiction, it's perhaps not what people are expecting, but it's what a dream come true. It's been a long time coming as well. We actually got the commission in 2019, and it's with the pandemic and everything, it's taken 2 years to actually make it. But yeah, it's, do you know what, the finished podcast, police car going by, apparently I live in a very quiet town, you wouldn't think it. But yeah, I'm so happy with the finished product. I never dreamed it would be this good. You know, the sound, the acting, the direction, everything is so elevated. And I think if you love an audio drama and if you love Doctor Who, then I think it's every bit as good as the ones that are on TV. So check it out. Check it out.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming to talk with us, to make the time. This is a truly fantastic book for our listeners. This will be available at your nearest independent bookstore or library very soon, and you should definitely check it out. And this is going to be goodbye from Jen and my co-host.
Jessica and our guest.
And Juno, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.